Episcopalians, as we're called, we are part of the Worldwide Anglican Communion, right? We're Anglicans. That's what we are. We got this name, Episcopalians, because we were trying to disassociate from England after the Revolution. But we're Anglicans. That's what we are. And as Anglicans, we are in what we call communion with not only the entire Anglican Church worldwide, but we are in communion with the Archbishop of, does anybody know? Canterbury. Good. I thought that would be a way too hard of a question for the kids. We sometimes refer to, it's all been men, so him. We often refer to him as the ABC, the Archbishop of Canterbury. So the ABC, you know, is our chief pastor, like the head of the church in that sense. Not in the same way as the Pope, because he doesn't really have real authority, but he has the authority of like the pastoral role and as chief pastor. And I mean, there is some authority there. It's complicated, but it's this really interesting process that we have. And we are right now in a process of selecting a new Archbishop of Canterbury, if you didn't know, because the other one retired. He stepped down. He resigned after he received a lot of criticism about not handling abuse complaints very well. And he talked about being absolutely overwhelmed by it. And so he stepped down. And so we're beginning, and I'm inviting all of you to pray with our brothers and sisters in England, because the British get to select him, for the next Archbishop of Canterbury. And so we're going to be praying for that. And just so you know, Anglicans are the third largest Christian denomination in the entire world. Anglicans are. We are only slightly smaller than the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. We have over 100 million members. We are the largest Protestant Christian communion on the globe. We have smaller numbers in the U.S., right? In the Anglican communion here, the Episcopal Church. But don't let that fool you. I mean, so we have over 2 million members or so here in the U.S., which makes, we rank like 15 in the U.S. But we are part of this incredible communion throughout the world. And in places, like if you visit Asia, places in Asia, places in Africa, where Anglicanism is just booming, it is growing, it is just gangbusters. Like, I hear stories from some of the clergy that talk about visiting there, and they talk about lines out the door as far as the eye can see for people to be confirmed. You know, we don't have that problem here. So it's not a long line, but we'd like it to be longer. But I mean, it really is. It is huge. We are also the only Christian denomination to have our own center right inside the Vatican. Did you know that? Yeah. There's the Anglican Center inside the Vatican, and you can go. You can go visit. We have a library there, and we have clergy there. And it is part of our relationship, our long, long history and relationship, ecumenical relationship with the Roman Catholic Church. And a lot of people didn't get much press, but not long ago, Pope Francis actually invited the Archbishop of Canterbury to be the presider over a prayer service right there in Rome, in the Vatican. Like, oh, that made some people mad. But it was a huge deal. It was like a huge deal to really acknowledge the Archbishop like that. So I, for one, am praying, and I'm praying for our brothers and sisters in England to be led by God's Holy Spirit for the selection of a truly godly leader, a new Archbishop of Canterbury, the 110th that we'll have coming probably very soon. So pray with me in that. Now, I bring Archbishop of Canterbury up because I want you to imagine for a moment, if you will, that you are a guest at a dinner party, and that the brand new, newly ordained Archbishop of Canterbury is one of the attendees. It's just a smallish gathering, so like you're there with the Archbishop. And you're at this dinner, and the hosts are doing a great job, the food is delicious, but at some point in the evening, one of the hosts suddenly gets down on her knees and begins to crack open this anointment, this perfume all over the Archbishop's feet, this most expensive perfume, and is using her hair to wipe his feet. And imagine the level of discomfort and awkwardness that this would be in the room. I mean, it would be raised to a fever pitch. Imagine, like, the potential, like, scandal or, like, gossip that could potentially come from this. What is going on here? And you'd be wondering, like, what is the archbishop going to do? What is he going to say? Will he ask her to please stop? Will he just try to make a graceful exit and leave now? Like, what's going to happen? But then imagine if the archbishop acted like Jesus in our gospel story today and allows her to continue this while everybody's just, what? And allows her to continue. And not only that, but when someone suggests that she needs to stop, he goes on to praise her, to commend her for this act. Now, in John's retelling of this story, this event takes place at the home of Lazarus, who, now, this is kind of that little reminder. Remember, he just got raised from the dead, and now he's, like, doing really ordinary things, like hosting a dinner party, right? And he's there with his sisters, Martha and Mary, who we know and love, right? But when Mary, in this story, begins to touch and wash Jesus' feet, and Jesus allows her to do it, you know, not only is she breaking incredible social norms, like, just like it would be for us to be in that, it would be, like, just absolutely beyond awkward socially. But you need to know she's breaking really strict religious norms here, too. Like, this would not be allowed. She'd not be allowed to touch him at all, let alone at this level, right, to do this. And so there's all these, like, rules and boundaries just being broken here. And Judas Iscariot is one of the guests, and he's not only shocked, like everybody else would have been, shocked, but he reveals his disgust, right? And his response reeks of self-righteousness. He suggests that, of course, well, that perfume should have been sold, and the poor should have been given the money, right? And then I like the little commentary, like, oh, he didn't really care about that. Now, see, we all know the end of the story, so, like, as soon as Judas is saying something, we don't like him, we're like, ugh. You know, we're immediately pretty judgmental. Like, we're quick to judge him. But, you know, we'd probably all be a little bit judgy in that moment. But what is she doing? This is, no. And, you know, not only that, but if we're honest, we know that we are all guilty of being self-righteous from time to time. Like this self-righteousness we see on display here. Especially if someone wrongs us or when they are acting outside of the, quote, acceptable boundaries. Right? In our minds, right? We just shake our heads, you know. Oh, shouldn't they know better? You know, we see people doing something, we just, that's just awful. How dare they? And yet, Jesus is always confronting us with the unexpected, constantly reminding us not to judge by appearances, to take a closer look at ourselves first, right? Now, once while I was in some heavy traffic along a side street, I had to, I'm pretty good at this, forcibly squeeze my car in between in front of a long line of cars so I could get into the right lane because I needed to make a right turn two blocks ahead. And as you know, it's hard to get into a line of backed up traffic. You know, people don't love you for that. But I did it and I squeezed right on in. And then when I got there, I realized that I was at the entrance of an intersection without a light or a stop sign. And so being the courteous driver that I am, dutiful driver that I am, I stopped at the entrance of the intersection instead of continuing to move forward so as not to block it. You know, I'm going to leave room for others. And I allowed, you know, car after car turning off that street into the intersection, you know, just go ahead, go in front of me. And then I noticed the guy behind me. He's like, you know, full on yelling, screaming, shaking his head, saying something. You know, I don't know exactly what, but he's not happy. And, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, ha, I'm feeling really self-righteous right now. Like, yeah. Oh, he's angry. He's angry that I let other people go ahead of us. Well, just because he's a jerk doesn't mean I have to be a jerk. You know, I'm a generous driver. I let people get ahead of me in traffic. I'm like, this guy, you know, this is all like, all, you know, really smug thoughts that I'm having in the car, you know, and it was a really long wait at the intersection. And then once the traffic began to move and I started to pull forward, you know, I noticed for the first time that he had his right-hand signal on and that he'd been just trying to turn into a lot that was right behind, you know, right there at the intersection the entire time. And so really, if I had just moved forward like even a few feet, like he could have just got in. But I had been blocking him for this incredibly long amount of time. And when I saw him turn in, I suddenly saw myself from his perspective. Like, you know, first of all, I had squeezed my way in front of this guy. I'd blocked him off. I'd forced him then to sit behind me for all this time, you know, and just so, like, he's just trying to make his right turn. No, I'm not saying you should need to get that mad at me. But, you know, I realized in that moment, if I'm looking at it from his perspective, like, I am the inconsiderate one. I am the absolutely most irritating person out there. And, okay, I get why he was angry. You know, we are in the habit, like, we see things from only our perspective. We are in the habit of justifying ourselves, our actions, and we judge others on appearances and on their behavior on the surface. You know, not to mention often from a very self-righteous perspective. And yet when we do that, we're being like Judas in the gospel story here. We are losing sight of who we really are, of who others are. And we easily misinterpret the actions of others, or we judge them harshly, even while we're elevating ourselves in our own minds. We become prone then to developing disdain or disgust for others, especially those who differ from us in some way, or perhaps those we even deem unworthy. There's no justification for making these hasty judgments on others. Jesus says in another gospel that recounts this same event a little bit differently. In that gospel story, he says, "The one to whom little is forgiven loves little." In other words, if our perspective is one that sees little need for our own forgiveness, for our own need of mercy, because after all, we're such good, upright, nice people and really generous drivers, you know, then we're really not getting it. We're actually adopting that role like last week of the elder son in the prodigal son story, you know. And so when we do that, we're missing out on the loving gratitude that could accompany the reality of ourselves and our sinfulness. And subsequent forgiveness, and again, then we're missing the party. We miss out on the party again. But when we know and we fully comprehend the overwhelming forgiveness and grace of God, because we are aware of the ways we fall short, which Lent is constantly inviting us to notice, right? To notice. Contemplate this. Then we are able to realize the love that God has for us. That abandon of love that God has, like the prodigal father, the forgiveness that is there, and then our capacity for love and gratitude and mercy can become that much greater for others. Now, in the grand scheme of things, great sinners have the capacity then, this is what's so cool about this, they have the great capacity to be great lovers of God and others. Because they know how much they've been forgiven. They are so aware of the grace that they have. They love much because they've been forgiven much. I like to, you know, quote, you've heard it before, but Oscar Wilde, who put it this way, "Every saint has a past and every sinner has a future." So how do we stop these habits of thinking, these attitudes? Paul tells us today in the letter to the Philippians, He had every reason to be the most confident in the flesh. And he lists out his accomplishments, right? He could be confident. They were vast. But he realized, he says, that whatever gains he had, they were nothing but rubbish. And by the word, that word that he's using in Greek that we translate as rubbish would translate much better in English to a word that I can't say in church. No. It's really what he's saying there. I mean, it's like all of these gains are nothing but that rubbish in comparison to knowing Christ as Lord. So what about us? I used to be chaplain in a women's jail. And some years ago, somebody asked me at church, like, oh, what's the difference between doing ministry in jail and ministry in the parish? And I said, and I stand by this, ministering in a jail is easier. It is way easier because all the pretenses are gone. Nobody's pretending like they don't need grace or they don't need forgiveness. They're not pretending to be perfect. And they're not just sitting there judging others, which actually happens a lot in church. Those in jail are so grateful, at least the women that I worked with, they're so grateful for the grace they've been shown by God, for the love that they found in Jesus. It's just, it's so outpouring. You know, Judas didn't see himself or Mary as they really were. And that is why he lacked loving gratitude and he judged her so harshly. But in humility, Mary saw more clearly. She knew who she was and she knew who Jesus was. She knew she was blessed beyond measure to be just in the presence of Jesus, God's Son. And so, in fact, she's just overcome. She's overcome with this love. She can't even help it. This is why she acts as she does. And so unexpectedly, Mary in this story becomes our model, a model to us of what love looks like and devotion and of faith. And so despite the appearances of that event, she then is the one that is given the honor. She gains this praise from Jesus. And it is her that gets the honor of preparing Jesus, God's very Son, for his upcoming death and burial. God lifts up the humble. And this is what Lent invites us to. We are called to have this kind of humility. And I pray that we will all strive for this humility and for this kind of grace when we look and interact and deal with others. Amen.